If the end of summer best reading lists does not include Smith Henderson's 4th of July Creek, then there just is no justice. There's very little in his story either, but the protagonist, a social worker in Montana, tries to restore some. Here's how we meet him in the opening paragraph.
The cop flicked his cigarette to the dirt and gravel road in front of the house and touched back his hat over his hairline as the social worker drove up in a dusty Toyota Corolla. Through the dirty window, he spotted some blonde hair falling, and he hiked in his gut, hoping that the woman in there would be something to have a look at. Which is to say, he did not expect what got out. A guy in his late 20s, maybe 30, pulling on a denim coat against the morning air blowing down the mountain, ducking back into the car for a moment, reemerging with paperwork. His brown corduroy pants faded out over his skinny ass, the knees too. He pulled that long hair behind his ears with his free hand and sauntered over. "Name's Pete," the social worker said, tucking the clipboard and manila folder under his arm, shaking the cop's hand. "We're usually women," he added, smiling with an openness that put the cop at ill ease.
Pete Snow often comes between cops and the crisis in the house behind them. Fourth of July Creek is set in Henderson's native Montana. His characters are the unseen poor and the only slightly better off social worker who, armed with diapers and baby formula, desperately tries to save other people's families, realizing way too late that he's losing his own. Smith Henderson joins us from Yellowstone Public Radio in Billings, Montana, with more on his terrific new novel, Fourth of July Creek. Smith, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
It's beautifully written, but it's also so disturbing. The squalor, the neglect that kids live in. This is a world you knew.
Yeah, I worked for several years in a group home in Montana, and so I had exposure to a lot of those kids and mm-hmm. their stories, which I have to say I did not use for this book. Those things were sacred. Those things that they went through were their stories. But being with them and with social workers, I saw something going on that I hadn't seen in a book that was set in the West, and I hadn't seen really much in literature at all, which was this investigator of families.
Yeah, and yeah. These terrible lives. And as you say, you didn't use the ones specifically that you worked with, but you thank in your book the social work professionals in both Texas and Montana. Pete Snow's family, his wife and child, moved to Texas, and then he works in Montana, as well as researchers in the schools of social work at the University of Texas and the University of Montana. You thank them not only for their insights, but for what they do. Because why? I mean, tell us more about what we see Pete do, about this life of a social worker.
There's a couple of things going on with Pete. The toughest thing, I think, is that he's living in western Montana, which is a pretty rough and tumble cowboy kind of culture. At the beginning of the book, he's about to see a president get elected who says the government is the problem. So he's kind of got a problem just in engaging with the culture generally.
Well, and this is in the era of Reagan. President Reagan has just been elected. Mm-hmm.
And he's suffering from a thing that, you know, only later got recognized in schools of social work, which was secondary trauma. It's just a thing that afflicts any first responder from time to time. But has been shown to be especially bad for social workers who work with young children.
No. I mean, we don't hear that flat out, but that seems to be the case. He seems both frozen and then, at any minute, hyper-reactive to something.
Yeah, he's very erratic, and he's starting to take on some of the attributes of the people he serves. He's letting his personal life spiral out of control. He's drinking constantly. He's being a terrible father.
Yeah. How much did you exaggerate these lives of, you know, mothers who forget that they have to feed children, the violence? Actually,
I had to dial it back. There were times when I was working on this book that the things that I was researching were so awful. I despaired for a while that I wouldn't even be able to, one, emotionally complete the book myself, or two, that the stuff I was discovering couldn't be written about. And a lot of it, it's dialed back, is what I'm saying. It's actually not an exaggeration whatsoever.
It's here and now. And we're talking with Smith Henderson, author of the critically acclaimed debut novel, Fourth of July Creek, a story set in 1980s Montana. At the center, social worker Pete Snow, whose involvement in the lives of his charges comes at the expense of his own family, especially Rachel, his 13-year-old daughter. We'll get to that. Smith Henderson once worked in a group home. He met kids who had survived neglect, abuse, poverty. He also grew up in Montana and really knows the state. And Smith Henderson, could you read another scene for us? And just to set this up, up. This is Pete, again, a social worker with Cecil, a young kid in his care. The two go into a diner. Cecil bolts, as Pete expects he would. Cecil runs out of the diner, knocks over a tourist postcard stand on the way. Metaphor alert there. And the waitress and everyone else in the diner swivel around and look at Pete as if to say, "Is this your son?" So if you could just read how Pete explains the situation.
"I'm from DFS," he said. "DF what now?" Everybody in the place was watching Pete. "I'm a caseworker," Pete said, "Department of Family Services." Some silence. A coffee cup set back in its saucer. "Well," the waitress said, stuffing her pad into her apron and taking up plates. There was a low mutter somewhere along the counter and a muffled snorting laugh. "You just gonna let him run wild?" someone asked. They looked at Pete, this long-haired organ where their tax dollars go, as he crammed a cold handful of the boy's fries into his mouth. They waited for him to do something. "You want I should call the highway patrol, hun?" the waitress asked. "Let's not throw our skirts over our heads just yet," Pete said. There was no good in letting her or the truckers, loggers, and farmers think this was an emergency, because it wasn't. The folks mumbled, resumed eating, lit cigarettes. The hostess at the register gathered up the postcards that had fallen into a harlequin floor mat of glaciers, geysers, jackalopes, and cottonwooded sunsets on the Missouri breaks. She set them on the counter and righted the display. Pete pinched a toothpick from the dispenser when he paid. He silently burped and picked through the cards.
Smith Henderson reading from his novel, Fourth of July Creek. The social worker, his charge has just bolted. He doesn't run after him because he knows this is a long arc, these relationships he has with these kids. And we're also seeing some of Montana there. Just a little bit about the character of the state of Montana.
You know, there's a couple of things Montana's known for. You know, it's known to be a really beautiful state filled with, you know, a lot of natural beauty. It's also known to be pretty fiercely independent, to the extent that a lot of people think it's, you know, a lot of gun nuts and libertarians and such. While those things are true and I engage with them in the book, I also wanted to kind of smash the notion that people out west are stoic. I loved Heath Ledger's performance in the Annie Proulx story.
Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, Brokeback Mountain. He, mm-hmm. You know, the cowboy who was kind of like talking like he's got marbles in his mouth. Mm-hmm. And those people exist, but my grandfather told so many stories, he just wouldn't stop talking. It was hilarious and funny, and people out here are much more loquacious and rich than they're often portrayed.
And we'll talk a little bit about that, what your own background brings to this.
My dad's still a logger. My grandfather was a butcher and a cowboy, and my great-grandfather was a dynamiter who blew up mountains to make railroads. But I grew up in Missoula, which is a college town, so a lot of my friends, their parents were hippies from the 70s who'd moved out to Missoula and, you know, were doctors and lawyers. And so I kind of found myself in this in-between place, you know, mm-hmm. where I'd get a little defensive if people would talk down about Western cowboys or whatever, and then at the same time be really drawn to good coffee and issues of the New Yorker or something.
Well, and we see those contrasts in the book. We also meet a character who enters about halfway through who is what some people picture in the mountains in Montana. His name is Jeremiah Pearl. He's a survivalist. And here you have all the conspiracy theories and paranoia. Pete has to interact with this character because the character has a child. We understand you were in the 10 years you were trying to write this book, you actually wrote two books at one point. One had Pete and one had this survivalist character. Why did you throw them together?
I didn't have a story until I put them together. They were so polar opposite, they needed to interact with each other. And once I realized that, it was just a matter of figuring out, you know, how to slowly get them together.
And why did you bring this character in, this survivalist?
Yeah.
What were you trying to say with him?
Early on, I came to the realization that I had these things that were dangerously close to caricatures, that you'd have this flawed bureaucrat on one side, and then you'd have this true believer, apocalyptic gun nut, you know, on the other side, and they would come to some sort of confrontation with each other. And so I really needed to concentrate on learning how to feel compassionate for both of these characters. And so I spent a lot of time with the Jeremiah Pearl's character really thinking through how you get to a place where you're on a mountain and you're ready for people to be coming for you.
Well, and part of what fuels him is his faith. This is, as others have described him, a gun-toting religious fanatic living in the woods preparing for end times. Well, I understand that part of what formed you is interacting with Christians when you were growing up.
I was thinking about that. Where did this character come from? And I have this specific, very vivid memory of going to a Bible camp. And we were sitting around after lunch, and these men came riding into the camp area. My recollection is that they were firing guns in the air even. They were wearing bandanas, and they were on horseback. And this truck came barreling through the meadow, and they were rounding up the kids to put them in the back of this trailer. And I got to the trailer, and instead of climbing in, I dove under it and crawled underneath the trailer and then underneath the pickup.
Really?
And broke for the, yeah, and broke for the trees. And at some point, it dawned on me when I was out there that this wasn't a real thing and that there was some, you know, lesson to be there. And I didn't actually learn the lesson because I was hiding in the woods, but I guess it had something to do with, you know, the government can come at any time and round people up.
And that's what they were trying to teach the kids.
I think so, yeah. And they could that they were rounding up Christians in China or something, you know. But there was this exquisite, exhilarating feeling of persecution at that moment. I still viscerally understand that if you think that the world is ginned up to take you out, you're going to resist.
Yeah. Well, and we see that in the characters that you've created. They are waiting for that truck to come.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you can see how many storylines there are. Let's go back to Pete Snow, the social worker, and this world of children in poverty that he's so desperately trying to fix. You know, there's a saying in 12-step groups, you know, don't try to save someone else until you have your own life preserver. You know, you jump in, a drowning man is going to drown you. And he's being drowned by these clients that he's trying to save. But in the meantime, he has a daughter who also needs him, and he completely forgets to save his own. I don't want to give too much away, but he's divorced from the mother. The child is in another state. He knows there's problems. He doesn't go. I mean, look, there are men who desperately want to see their children more, you know, who are in divorce situations. We're not talking about that guy. We're talking about someone who seems unbelievably compassionate but does not go to see his own child. Can you explain that?
He's broken. He's on an autopilot when it comes to his job. He can be very compassionate. But early in the book, his wife has betrayed him, and he is really hurt, and his reaction is to run away.
Well, and too late, he realizes that he has also run away from his daughter. Yeah. Again, we don't want to give too much away, but we become very invested in her. Are you going to, in a future book, tell us what happened to Rachel?
I don't know.
Please do.
Okay. I think I'm going to have to. It seems like that's what people want to know. But I needed to finish this book, you know.
Yeah, so. 10 years.
She has, you know, the note I wanted you to come away with was that she has resources. She's learned things throughout the course of the book, and there's more story for her.
Smith Henderson's debut novel, the one that took 10 years, is 4th of July Creek. It's getting raves. Smith, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll have an excerpt at hearnow.org. And while there, check out producer Emiko Tamagawa's Books to Read This Summer list. I put this one at the top. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art with Jim Hodges. The show features mirror mosaics, walls of flowers, and denim tapestry, now on view, ICABoston.org.